I'm Vicky, I'm an addict. Oh, I hate this microphone. I feel really nervous tonight. I need to just acknowledge that because Dean asked me just outside, so this is completely, you know, au naturel. So I suppose the first thing I want to say is that I'm really grateful to be here tonight and to have been asked, you know, to do this, to be given the privilege of speaking for this amount of time, and you guys being willing to listen. I did offer to pass out earplugs earlier, but I mean, I think the simplest thing for me to do in a share that I haven't really prepared for that's this long is to start at the beginning. And so that's what I'll do. And and I find it quite difficult to start at the beginning because for me, my beginning was quite painful, really, like I suppose, you know, quite a few other people in here. And I always like to talk about the family, really. You know, if people have heard my share before, that's all I've got. So, you know, I'm not going to worry about repeating myself. I grew up in a very strange situation with two parents who were both very isolated from each other. Mother was an alcoholic. Dad was a rageaholic, paedophile, perpetrator type. They were both caught in a state of victimhood with which I identify because, you know, I spent many years in a state of victimhood. And self-pity, really. Self-pity was probably one of the biggest character defects in our family, I would say. And a lot of the family dynamics sort of ran off self-pity, competition, put-downs, and terror and shame. And it was a really frightening place to grow up. And my dad was also a gun dealer, so we grew up with in a kind of big old house, if you can imagine it, in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by, we had a big cannon in the front of the garden. It was like 40 foot long or something. I don't know, it was very long. Well, not that long, but very long. And this mad man in the house who was so defended that everywhere it was just like guns, bullets, swords, weapons. And it was just really scary. There was me and there was my siblings and the mum and dad. So basically, when people say, you know, this is a disease of a relationship with the self, I really understand what that means because the whole family was diseased, I was diseased, you know, and I say, use the word disease in the sense of really spiritually unwell. And, you know, we had a spiritual malady. So school for me was a kind of escape, really. I quite like school. It was a relief. I went to a convent with nuns, and I know everybody sort of moans about nuns, but I liked them. They were good. But what happened to me at school was, after some of the scenarios that were going on at home, those coping mechanisms weren't working anymore, and I got involved with boys and other friends. And we got into, it was the mid-70s, you know, we were all sort of got into the sort of dope smoking, speed taking, whatever type of thing that everyone was doing at that time, or everybody I knew was doing at that time. And I think what happened to me was that, unbeknownst to me, my mind started to unravel. Anything that I was using my intellect to hold together was no longer strong enough. My mind started to completely unravel. And I managed to keep it together through school and, you know, get a job and la la la. But by the time I met a fully fledged addict, and as a fully fledged codependent, it just went crash, you know. And you know, they talk about the still small voice of the disease that speaks to you in your own voice. Well, I'm with this addict, and one day I realised that he isn't going to stop using heroin. Like there is, I just knew, it was obvious. And at that time, I hadn't been willing to engage in that far down the road. But there was a little voice that came in my head that was my own voice, that sounded like my own voice, but I now understand is the voice of this disease. And it's the part of the disease in me that is a state of internal collapse. You know, that internal collapse when you just give up. And you press, you know, you press that button. And the voice said, if you can't beat them, join them. Right? If you can't beat them, join them. So I gave up whatever vestige I had in my life. and I joined him in my codependency and my love addiction, and then I used some heroin, and then that was a euphoric release from all my troubles. And it took me many, many years to understand that what I thought was the drug was giving me actually was that it wasn't what the drug was giving me, it was what the drug was taking away. And what that drug took away was all the pain and the angst and the terror and the fear of my history. That's what it took away. So what happened was, the first time I ever used gear, I got this massive euphoric release that we know about. And that euphoric release wasn't the drug that I'd given so much power to for all those years of chasing that euphoric release. It was the lack of pain. It took away the emotional pain. And the release was so great from someone just stopping that pain, or something stopping that pain, that it felt euphoric. I felt free. So I couldn't wait to do it again. And that might sound really simple and really obvious, but it took me many, many years to understand it was never about the drug, actually. It was simply about the absence of pain. For me. You know, and Tommy spoke earlier about, you know, we go to places that are unspeakable and we do things that are unspeakable. And I might sit here tonight looking like whatever, but believe me, I have been to the depths. And it's miraculous, really, because I often share this, but I'm going to share it again because it's a special night for James, because he's 32 years clean today. And this is one of the miracles of NA, is that James and I first met up the road in Charing Cross Road because I was trying to buy some gear, but he had some methadone powder. I'd never met him before, but he was up there and we just encountered each other. And I remembered him because he looked so awfully miserable. And I was probably literally 3.5 stone lighter than I am now, and James was pretty skinny as well in those days. Oh. And the miracle of that is that you can come from that particular state through this fellowship into a place where we're sitting tonight. We've been married for 15 years. He's 32 years clean. He is the main reason I came back to NA 8 years ago, because of his inspiration, his example. And, you know, we've just gone through a lot. And, you know, without this fellowship, we wouldn't have had the platform through which to go through it. And I wouldn't be sitting here tonight. Do you know what I mean? So it's taken us from the Charing Cross Road to Trafalgar Square. And it was a very long, long, long journey. 33 years of a long... Is it 33? I can't even remember, but it's a long journey. And I also want to acknowledge dear Tony, who's sitting in the front as well, who's a dear friend of mine from the past, who NA brought us back in touch with each other again, which is fabulous. You know, these are all miraculous gifts for me in recovery. And I don't have to go and be a bag lady anymore. I don't have to not bath for a year. And I don't have to have no teeth. And I don't have to inject myself of whatever. I don't have to live that war horror story thing. I don't have to get arrested. I don't have to prostitute myself. I don't have to do any of those things that I used to do. And also, the most important thing is that when I listen to that voice about if you can't beat them, join them. Do you know when recovery started for me? Was when I started listening. And I only started listening when I became so desperate that I was willing to come to NA and start to listen, actually. Because my ears were just completely closed. And in a way, those character defects that carried me through my childhood became completely redundant and actually very damaging, because they stopped me from listening. They kept me shut down into what I thought was a safe place, but actually became very unsafe. So when I came to NA, I was dragged in 1982 by somebody. I certainly didn't clean up then, but I want to acknowledge him as well, because he could never get it, but he 12-stepped an awful lot of people, Jimmy R, and he 12-stepped me. I'm very grateful to him for that. And it just shows you that even if people don't manage to clean up, they're still of service. You know, he did a lot in NA in the early days. And then you know, I came into NA finally, cleaned up, stayed around for a few years, worked the steps to the best of my ability, got the sponsor, did all the things that I thought you should do, but I did them in a way to the best of my ability at the time. But it was more about externals. It was about trying to do the things that you're meant to do, which is fine. And then I relapsed and left the fellowship. But I would say I had a big emotional relapse. I had a massive, which is the drug, the alcohol relapse is very important, but the emotional relapse that preceded the alcohol relapse is huge. And for me, one of the things that happened was when I was in early recovery the first time, my dad shot himself in the head and he just ended his particular nightmare. You know? And that was very traumatic, and traumatic for the whole family. And he kind of left some writing that is unrepeatable here, which was also we read after he died, and it was extremely disturbing. And I remember the police coming to take all the guns out of the house, and there was he'd gone so nuts, actually. There was rocket launchers in there and Uzi submachine guns. I mean, God knows where he got them from. He had really lost the plot. And I had a very complicated relationship with my father, because when I was using, at one point he said to me, no daughter of mine should use a substance that I haven't used, about heroin. Get me some. Right? So I got my dad some smack, and I was so scared he'd OD, I gave him a little bit of coke, gave him a bit of coke as well to try and ease him out a bit, you know. It's funny now, but it's horrific, isn't it, really? You know, I think I was 24. I mean, you know, this nutter father. Anyway, he just wasn't very well. And, you know, my mother wasn't happy about that. I spent many, many years... I'll tell you one thing my father said, though. He got into his pyjamas, he got into bed, and he went, "I must never do that again. I'm in heaven." But the thing is that I spent years after my dad killed himself being really, really even more angry than I was already. And I was a really angry kid. I was a really angry teenager, but I suppressed it all. I internalised it. I took it out on myself. I beat myself up. And I'm not so angry with him today, because I've been able to practice through working steps and doing service and practicing the principles of this program in all my affairs, some detachment and compassion, and understand that he really wasn't very well, because nobody that is okay behaves like that. And that doesn't mean that his behaviour was acceptable, because it definitely wasn't, and it is unacceptable. And if he walked in here right now, I'd be horrified. But I'm not so angry. I'm not as angry anymore. But I had to allow myself to be angry. And you know when people talk about forgiveness and they say forgive, forgive, forgive. I'm not sure that forgiveness means making it okay. I think that's why my codependent nature would go towards that. But actually, I don't need to make anything okay, because sometimes things just simply aren't okay. And they're not fixable. And what is broken sometimes is broken. And that's the end of it. And acceptance is the price of freedom. And Robert always said that to me from the beginning. But acceptance is the price of freedom. You know, and my ex-partner, who never managed to clean up but loved NA, he always said, you know, the truth is the best lie. Tell the truth. Yeah. And, I mean, what brought me to my knees in my using was the death of my daughter, really. That was, she was, I think I've shared this many times, but for people who haven't heard it, I woke up one morning, I couldn't wake up because I was so stoned. And when I woke up, I went to pick my daughter up. She was 7.5 weeks old, and she was dead, basically, of cot death. So that's been a massive journey, you know. But again, you know, through working the steps, through outside help, through a lot of time, a lot of healing, you know, she's probably closer to me now, and I can speak about her now without that agony, you know, and it's okay. And I had some very, very good news today. And it's interesting to look at my daughter, my daughter Charlotte, the one that died, you know, in the context of all that death and all that hell. And today, you know, again, through NA, really, because it wouldn't have happened without the 12-step fellowships, I got a fantastic WhatsApp from my daughter today, Anna, and she passed her final chartered accountancy exam. You know, she's just got engaged. She's coming home tomorrow with her boyfriend. We've got a big celebration going on. And this is the joy of recovery. Do you know what I mean? This is where it gets better. So if anyone's struggling or anyone's new, hang on, because it does get better. There have been many times in my recovery which have been absolute hell. You know, I've gone through relationship hell, breakups, people disappearing and having babies with somebody else and then telling me 6 months later they're having a baby and all this shit. You know, an enormous amount, an archive of misery, but it does get better. All we have to do and all I've done is keep coming back, work the steps to the best of my ability, and I'm probably not the most, you know, adherent, but I have worked through the steps, the last step five that I did, last step four and five I did, I think really unlocked something. Being of service, you know, carrying the message and just making the tea, quietly putting the chairs away. It doesn't have to be anything major, you know, for me. The quiet way sometimes is good for me. And I'd also stop being so self-absorbed and self-interested, you know, thinking about somebody else really helps me. You know. And I mentioned at the beginning of this share about feeling like a victim from an early place. Well, that's because I was a victim. You know, a child that's abused is a victim. But it doesn't mean that I have to carry that victimhood and the self-pity on through the whole of my adult life. And if things don't go my way, well, you know, at some point I've got to understand that's the way of the world. Life just isn't fair sometimes. At other times it's more than fair. You know, it's about balance. It's been about balance, finding that balance. And I think the other thing that really has helped me is developing a sense of humour, because I didn't have one. You know, I didn't have a sense of humour. I lost it. And I think a healthy sense of humour and the ability to laugh at oneself. One of the funniest things that helped me with that, actually, I've got to share it with this moon. I do shows and exhibitions for a living. And so a few years ago, we were away at a show doing this show. It was badminton horse trials, right? So we're selling things there, yeah? Anyway, we went out in the evening, I had some fish, I got poisoned, okay? Went back to the B&B, woke up at 2 in the morning, poisoned, threw up in the toilet, and flushed the loo. But because I was so tired, remembered I hadn't taken my frontal denture out, and so I flushed it down the toilet. I was, this is God's little joke on me, it was. Because I had to get the train back the next day with a big black scarf around my head. I looked like something out of Al-Qaeda. And I was on a train full of Arsenal drunk football fans who were seriously abusing me, and guess what? I couldn't say anything to them. And for some reason, the dentist couldn't seem to make me a temporary denture, so I had 6 weeks with no teeth. But do you know what I did with that? Because I looked like a vampire, right? Or an angry lion or something. So I went around terrorising the family, who I couldn't ever show them that I didn't have teeth before. So I had great fun scaring James and Anna, and it was really brilliant, actually. And it just shows you what you can get over with a sense of humour. And that particular scenario helped me to laugh at myself. It really did. Nothing's that bad. I've been quite ill this year. I've had a horrible sort of kidney thing going on, but I think it's getting better now. And what that gave me was an enormous amount of gratitude for health that I have, for well-being, for people that are in my life today. You know, I sit down sometimes and I think about the people that aren't here, the people that didn't make it into the rooms, the people that couldn't stay in the rooms, the people that didn't get back. I mean, I was lucky enough to get back, you know. So I had 13 years out of NA. So I was one of the lucky ones that I got back. And I like to remember those people in the meetings, people like Jimmy, people like Jonathan, you know, people who you just love in your heart, you know what I mean? And I think it's just good to bring them into this. Yeah. Because I've really been thinking lately that, you know, I'm a long time dead. I'm going to make sure that I enjoy this life. Like, just being here together tonight is kind of precious, you know? That God's brought us all here. I think it's amazing that we are all sitting sober on a Friday night in the West End of London, and that we'll stand up at the end and hold each other's hands and say the Serenity Prayer together from where we all come from. You know, that is, who would have thought that? If we all ran back 15 years, who would have thought that we would all be here tonight like this? So I am a grateful customer of NA. And I've just, I've done many things, you know, I've got outside help, I've gone to other fellowships, but this is my home base. And the other thing I think that's really important that I want to just talk about briefly is I've needed to learn about healthy boundaries, because in my family there weren't any boundaries, that it was boundaryless, you know. It was just that there were no healthy sexual boundaries, there was no healthy emotional boundaries, there was no healthy anything boundaries. And children were owned, you know, and you had to toe the line. And it's quite sad today because of that situation, I don't really have relationships with my brothers or sisters. You know, one sister I just about talk to on the phone once a year, but it's not worked out with the others, and that's okay, but it's kind of sad, really. But I don't have to be around people who are not good for me, and I'm probably not good for them where they are either. So, you know, I've learned now that if something isn't working in a family situation or friendship situation, it's okay to let it go. I don't have to keep trying to make something work that is hopeless. And the boundaries of self-care, self-compassion, detachment with compassion for the self first, please. How can I have compassion for you if I haven't got compassion for me, you know? And simple things like in the middle of a big row with somebody, being the one that steps down and offering to make a cup of tea rather than sticking the knife in further, you know. I mean, somebody in another fellowship suggested that to me once, and it was a brilliant suggestion. It came from an 86-year-old lady who was obviously experienced. And just that thing of, you know, to take the heat out of a situation is better than to keep fueling it, because I don't know about anybody else in this room, but I was very addicted to drama and adrenaline. You know, it had to be very dramatic or I didn't feel anything. It had to have a real impact. You had to almost be punched in the face because you're so numb you can, you know. And I actually can't do drama today. It's bad for my health, you know. It's bad for my kidneys. It's bad for my blood pressure. So I've learned to walk away probably more than I used to, I would think. I mean, James would know more about that. And just come back from holiday. I just feel very grateful. Feel really grateful. In my office, I keep a gratitude book that anyone who goes in there, if they want to, can write down something they feel grateful for. And it's really nice to look back at that, because it's nice to see what other people have written as well as yourself. You know, gives me kind of inspiration. If I think of what I'm struggling with today, I'm probably struggling with fears of my own mortality, fears of losing people I love, because I'm very in touch with the fact that you lose people in the end, that we've only got each other for it's a temporary gift. You know? Life on life's terms. I'm powerless over everything except whether I'm willing, you know, really to make a good decision or a bad decision, the next thing, really. And I was certainly very powerless, and my life was certainly very unmanageable. And I came to believe in a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity, and I like to call that power God. And it's God as I understand God. And the freedom of NA that gives us the freedom to decide to have our comprehension of a God, which is our understanding of God and not anybody else's, is fantastic for me. So. And I'd very happily turn my will and my life over. I surrender completely because I believe that God has carried me through. I look back at some of the things that have happened both in my using life and my recovery life, and I think, I just don't know how I got through that. How do you get through that? How do you get through all of those drugs and stay alive? How do you get through certain things that happen to you in recovery and relationships or work or whatever it is and still function, you know? And when you can't, your friends or this fellowship can hold me up, hold us up. Being honest and making a thorough personal inventory was a mystery to me at the beginning. I've done 8-step fours, and I would say the last step four was the only fully honest step four that I was able to work. But I worked them to the best of my ability at the time. Sharing with somebody else, you know, just starting to get a bit of humility and a bit of openness and lower that pride level a bit that it's okay to share, that it's safe to share, that you're not going to be told you're an idiot or useless or stupid or whatever, you know, that what you've done isn't, that others, someone else has done it as well, you know. Becoming aware I had character defects was difficult. But once, the interesting thing is once I became aware that I had character defects and what they might be, my shame levels went down because they were no longer hidden. So I was able to get that out, you know? All those social instincts and primary instincts that had been hit suddenly were exposed to the light and they just flowered into more of assets as well as defects. and the defects that I have now, I can be gentle with them. I can think, well, okay, you know, we know where that's coming from. It's all right, Vicky. It's okay. You know, you're not perfect. Humbly asking God to remove my shortcomings. Well, I didn't know how to humbly ask originally, and I very arrogantly said, get rid of my ego then. And I got 5 years of a life lesson about what it means to have your ego ripped off you, and I don't recommend it. Humbly is there for a good reason. Making a list of all persons I'd harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. I'm still not willing to make amends to them all, I have to be honest. There's one or two that are on the maybe list, and that's okay. That's okay, because I don't have to make amends to people where it's not safe for them or for me. Where it causes harm to, you know, them or others, others being me as well. So that's how I take step 9. Step 10, continue to take personal inventory sometimes. And, you know, I try. But, I mean, I've probably got shot blind in lots of areas. But step 11, through prayer and meditation. Prayers are powerful, I think. I think prayers get answered whether I understand how they get answered or not. I had a really good example of that I'll briefly share in the meeting. I was another exhibition one day. I had to, at Olympia, I had to get a sort of van to the back of Olympia to pack down the exhibition. And you can never get a space on a Sunday morning because all the guys have got their lorries in. They know how to do it. Anyway, I prayed before I left because I had the horrors about something else. And I thought, I haven't got time for this anxiety. God, please, I'm turning this problem over to you. I've got to get to Olympia. I've got to find a space. But this other anxiety, I can't deal with it today. So I turned that over, got to Olympia. There was a space right outside my favourite cafe, Shandy's. If anyone ever goes there, it's a good cafe. Parked the van, thought, this is good. This is 2 hours after I prayed. There's a Ford Fiesta in front of me with a number plate that said J14, which was my stand number that year, VAT, and VAT was what I'd had the horrors about. So if people don't think that prayer works, I suggest trying it. I've got that as I photographed it. I've got it on my Mac, so every time I feel terrified, I look at it. Prayer answered. Right? And step 12, you know, we try to carry this message and practice these principles in all our affairs. Try and be nice to people. I would like people to be nice to me, and if I want people to be nice to me, I need to be nice to you. You know, I think every relationship is every healthy relationship is a good two-way process. It's like, I can't be a user, I can't be a taker, and I can't be a total giver. I've got to be fluid. So hence, see, the dog agrees. So yeah, two-way process is really important. And also, I'm going to finish by saying, I relapsed and I came back, and it takes a lot of courage because I had to get, you know, I had to get over my ego and my sense of false pride. But the rewards of that were amazing, you know. And people that I've re-met having this process to go through on a deeper level, and I do believe I'm on a deeper level with it. I'm just very, very grateful. I'm grateful that you guys listened. I'm grateful that I'm here tonight. I'm grateful for dear friends. And thank you for listening. Yeah.